I'm going to open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Today is April 14th, and I am going to see if I can let some people go here. Let me carry over the work sessions on House Bill 3368, House Bill 2741, House Bill 3211, House Bill 3412, House Bill 3457, House Bill 3367, House Bill 2723, House Bill 3217, House Bill 3214, House Bill 3221, House Bill 3222, House Bill 3431, and House Bill 3282. I was expecting a huge exodus right then. Dang it. Okay. I'm going to try and get through some of our work sessions that have members here at least. So let me open a work session on House Bill 2633 and ask Representative Leininger, and we'll have Sean Jillians come talk from the House of Development and or Natural Resource Industries. So he'll be up in just a second. And there he is. Okay, tell us where we're at on 2633.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I'm State Representative Ann Leininger. Thank you so much for having this work session on House Bill 2633. House Bill 2633 is intended to help communities respond to and minimize risk from natural hazards. It deals with natural hazards including tsunami, earthquake, landslide, flood, coastal erosion, and wildfire. And as I think you have heard as well, we're spending a lot of money, particularly in the wildfire arena, I think maybe $70 million, close to that in the last 2 years, from general funds trying to respond to wildfires. The Oso landslide showed all of us how dangerous landslides can be and include loss of life. And there's been some wonderful work done by people from the coast, but people from all around Oregon on resilience and resilience planning, resiliency task force work. And this legislation fits into it. It would have LCDC direct some voluntary guidance to help communities minimize risks from these natural hazards. And as to a few parameters, it would have LCDC do a rulemaking so that communities know how to respond to those issues and fulfill their obligations under Goal 7 and other land use planning goals. The key thing that I think you'll want to note is that the Dash 4 amendments are the result of some really great teamwork. And I want to thank Mr. Jillians with the Realtors, the Home Builders Association, the Farm Bureau, Oregonians in Action was part of conversations, AOC, LOC, Representative Clem, Representative Helm did a lot of work, Representative Gomberg. We've worked really hard to try to come up with something that is workable for communities and not too burdensome and costly, but still helps us address real risks. And I think we have, in the form of the Dash 4, I defer to Mr. Jillians to confirm or deny what I said. I would welcome your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to confirm and deny. We are in support of the Dash 4 amendments. Appreciate the leadership of yourself, Mr. Chair, and the sponsors of the bill, and allowing us to craft some amendments that we feel are workable. The first part of the amendments obviously established sort of some best practices for local communities that we think will be very beneficial and actually provide some resources in that. Happy to answer any questions on the specifics of the Dash 4s.
Any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little more on the Dash 4s, a short summary, por favor.
So what the, thank you, Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, what the Dash Force do is take some of the parameters and put them into best practice voluntary guidance instead of requiring a rulemaking from the outset on those parameters. So it makes very clear that the guidance is voluntary, although, of course, we encourage communities to undertake it. The Dash Force also make clear that farm structures are not going to be subject to movement based on the rules under here. It makes clear that LCDC will communicate with a wide range of partners, federal and state agencies, to incorporate their learnings and advice as they do the rulemaking. And that's roughly it. What would you add?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gillian, I just add that the first part, the best practices sort of thing, is pretty much any natural hazard that you could think of is sort of included in there, and it's DLCD working with other agencies to sort of come up with best practices there. I think that's important to stress because there's so many natural hazards bills introduced this session. We sort of thought this is the one omnibus bill that should hopefully address those issues for the session. We really like that part of the bill, and I explained to Representative Cowan earlier today. That's the part we love. The second part we can live with, which is mandatory rulemaking for LCDC. It wouldn't have been our first choice, but we appreciate the proponents working with us, and so I think we came to a pretty good compromise on the rulemaking part, which is Section 2, and it contains some important language about having safe harbors for right. local governments to be able to ensure that they can comply with whatever rulemaking comes out of the commission.
Vice Chair Post.
Okay. Will we have more folks?
I don't think so.
Our panel? Okay.
We could haul someone up if you want, but otherwise, no.
Either one of you may be able to answer then this question. I just wanted to, I had notes to myself to double check with some people, and I want to see either if they're here or if maybe Sean or Representative Langer can answer. I had note that League of Oregon Cities was concerned with some of the language. Do you know where they are now? Let's take them one at a time. So, okay, she's a yes in the back. I had a note that League of Women Voters supported the concept originally, yeah. So they're good. Okay. Oregon Realtors, you already said, right? Home Builders Association. Dave Honeycutt had some issues.
Jillian's nose.
Yeah, I would say that Mr. Honeycutt's aggressively neutral on the bill.
Okay, and then...
With the Dash Fours, I should clarify.
Also, 1,000 Friends of Oregon were backers originally.
Uh-uh.
Okay, so everybody's made nice then? Is that generally the consensus?
Yeah, I don't know of anybody who still has problems with this bill.
Okay, thank you.
That's how we like to do things in this committee, if we can. If we can.
Thank you to the leadership of Chairman Clark.
It wasn't me. It was the sponsors and Sean working together.
Okay. Take it when you can get
any
it.
Any further questions for these two? Okay. Thank you. So, did I already open the work session? Yeah, I did. So, I would take a motion.
Wait for me. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2633, dated April 9, 2015.
Vice Chair Helm moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2633, dated April 9, 15. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2633 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the committee Joint Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2633 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the committee Joint Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Graham.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill sent to Ways and Means. Let me open a, see if we have anybody else that's from the legislature here. It doesn't look like it. I'm just gonna get through these work sessions quickly because I want to get them off the calendar. Okay, so let me open a work session on House Bill 2831. This is the Representative Helms' property line adjustment bill. Same deal here. We had discussions with the various parties. Oregonians in Action was the one that had issues. They've talked with everybody, I think, who had concerns about the bill offline. So with that, I would take a motion, then we can discuss further if we want to.
Chair Clem, excuse me. Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2831 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2831 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Can the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Excused.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. We'll have our Vice Chair Helm carry it. Okay. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2277. We've got these dash two amendments. Mr. Landauer, why don't you come up here, and if he is, and then Farm Bureau, did you want to comment on the dash twos? Not particularly. Or, yeah, come on up then. Tell us about these dash twos.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Mark Landauer on behalf of Multnomah County Drainage District. You'll recall that you heard this bill some time ago. There are a number of folks who had expressed interest in the measure after the hearing, one, of course, being the Farm Bureau. I'll certainly allow them to make their own comments. We modified the bill a great deal to try to address their concerns. Their primary concern seemed to be the ordinance and making authority that was that is contained in the measure that was before you. The applicability of that ordinance making authority applied to all drainage districts in the state of Oregon. As a result of the concerns expressed by the Farm Bureau, we have limited that ordinance making authority to just the drainage districts located in Multnomah County. You'll recall that Multnomah County Drainage District operates two drainage districts and one drainage district improvement corporation, all of which protect a great deal of land area along the Columbia River. As a result of their going through a certification process with the United States Army Corps of Engineers and a potential mapping, remapping, with the FEMA, this bill is necessary in order for them to go through that process, get accreditation by both the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and with hopefully an accreditation and certification given by the Corps, the FEMA will consider continuing their existing flood mapping, allowing for folks to have access to flood insurance and whatnot. So with that, unless there are further questions, be happy to answer those. And I do have the executive director of Multnomah County Drainage District with me, Reed Wagner.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm mostly up here to answer any questions anybody has about Farm Bureau's position. We are still against the bill, but recognize that it has a more limited scope with Mr. Landauer's amendments and appreciate him doing that.
Any questions? I think I lied when I said nobody was opposed to it then. Sorry. Representative Witt.
I'd be interested in more specifics about the Farm Bureau's lingering opposition.
When we vetted this bill with our members, one of the primary concerns expressed is that expansion of drainage district ordinance authority would allow drainage districts to essentially act for, so the current process is if a drainage district wants to do something, requires somebody to do something, they have to go through a lawsuit process unless they have, you know, an existing easement or some sort of existing right-of-way. And the concern was that this would kind of flip that process, and the ordinance power would then apply to everybody within the district, and our members would have to, if they thought the ordinance was overly broad or had some other issues, they would have to then go through and initiate a lawsuit to challenge that ordinance. And so just concerned about that expansion of power and how that might be used by drainage districts. But, you know, we appreciate the limiting to Multnomah County, because it's much more limited in scope as against the drainage districts located all over the state.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 4-1-15.
Vice Chair Post moves the Dash 2 amendments dated 4-1-15. Any discussion? These are the narrowing from statewide to the just Multnomah County. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, we have a discussion.
Okay to go here?
Yeah. Chair Clem, I move HB 2277 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2277 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Gomper?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Excused.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. And whose bill is this? I don't recall.
It's at the request of the Drainage District.
But who's the sponsor?
Committee
bill. I'll figure out the sponsor later. Sometime in the hearing, I'll figure out the sponsor. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2463. Colleagues, this was the bill we heard about a long, long, long time ago, and it had to do with authority to remove derelict structures that were on submerged lands. Representative McLean was the one who had ongoing questions, had a lot of different meetings, and eventually we've got these Dash 1 amendments. This bill goes to Ways and Means from here. No, it doesn't.
I think it has a fiscal now.
It does. Is Representative McLean joining us later?
No.
I will confirm that, but I believe it does.
He's okay with the bill moving.
Now. Okay.
Can you tell us about the Dash 1 amendments?
Sure. Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Chris Castelli. I'm with the Oregon Department of State Lands. Just wanted to bring Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2463 up to you today. We worked with Surf Rider Foundation in particular on these. There are a couple things this amendment does. The first is it defines marine debris in the bill, and then it specifically lists marine debris as something that the department can use the submerged lands enhancement fund to help remove. Lastly, it sets up a new section 5, which directs the department specifically to adopt rules to carry out a couple different provisions. The first is to provide notice and opportunity for a hearing prior to the seizure of abandoned or derelict structures. So this provision works in conjunction with Section 2 of the existing bill, which requires the department to provide notice and opportunity to hear prior to removing any sort of abandoned or derelict structures from state-owned submersible lands. And then the second part requires the department to adopt rules to sort of establish a process for which folks can make requests to the department to use monies from the Submerged Lands Enhancement Fund. And this was important to set up a process that, say, ports or Surf Rider or Watershed Councils or other NGOs could go ahead and request to use that fund.
Okay. There is no fiscal on it, you're right, so there's no subsequent referral needed. Vice Chair Post.
Just again, sure. Chair Clam, just to, because I want to refer back to my notes. The wonderful thing about this system is you can see where you were 3 weeks ago and kind of what was Bill thinking back then. I had written a note to myself, and maybe this has been answered just now, the concern surrounding whether the notice requirements were sufficient, and I think you have addressed that, haven't you? That's one.
Chair Clem, Rep. Post, I'd hope so.
Okay.
We did, I don't know if you recall, we met February 11th to discuss this, and I think we emailed you and Rep. McClain some additional information on how we would typically flush this out through rulemaking. We had two examples. One was from our public recreational restriction rules, which is more of a general notice, and then we had a more specific example from our water releasing rules, which this rulemaking would likely go into, about how we would notice an individual specifically.
And that's, Section 5?
Yeah, Section 5 is the new one. Section 5 has the rulemaking requirement for the department to develop a process.
Right, then I don't know why I wrote this, but I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, that this, whether this should be adopted statutorily or by rule. I don't know what I was thinking at that time, but that was Bill 3 or 4 weeks ago, whenever that was.
Chair Clem, Rep. Post, it's statutorily requiring us to establish a process through rule, is the way this amendment is drafted.
Thank you very much.
It does have a fiscal. Okay. We think it does now have a fiscal and does have a subsequent referral. We may have to hold this over and figure this out. Any further questions about these dash?
So, Chair Clinton, I don't know if it helps for the fiscal, but the revenue that would go into this fund is already it would be from revenue already generated from submerged personal land. We'd be taking a portion of the revenue collected from water releases, really, easements, the dock registration, and putting it off into this fund so that we can help clean up those and help manage those lands more effectively.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm just going to close the work session on this. That's good enough for now. Close the work session on House Bill. Ooh. We have people here on other things. Or do you want to ask him while we got him?
Yeah, so 2463 is the one we're on, right?
Correct.
And so you're thinking of moving this?
We're not entirely clear where, but that's what we were thinking about.
So there is no subsequent referral?
That's what we're trying to figure out.
Oh, okay.
And so I was going to close it while we figured out and come back to it.
One thing I want to add then, because I'm gone Thursday.
Yep.
And you might be as well, I understand. So.
Correct.
So if we move this to Ways and Means, I can certainly weigh in there.
Yeah.
Since this may be my last opportunity, and we're in a work session, right?
Yes.
Okay, so then I just want to address the members of the committee.
Yep.
You know, my concern is the process issue and of the determination of what's abandoned, and then, of course, the follow-up issue of trying to then charge fees to and assess penalties against somebody. The disconnect is a lack of process determine it's abandoned, and then once it's abandoned, we determine it's abandoned, then we're going to hunt you down and make you pay. So if there's a process of recovery of costs, then why don't we just do that at the start so we know whose it is? So the inconsistency in the department, and has been my main problem with the bill. And I just don't like the thought of the incentive of Department of State Lands to declare things abandoned. The incentive is for them to hunt them down, the owners, after something's been declared abandoned, because then they have a recovery. Just like I'm not a fan of the pre-sentencing forfeitures, I'm not a fan of any time the government has a financial incentive to take from a citizen value without process. And because I'm not a fan of that, I've not been a fan of this bill. Now, if what you're saying is that you guys are going to solve all that in by administration, I suppose that would give me a degree of comfort that I don't have, but it still doesn't get me support. Does that make sense? Do you understand my main concern with the bill?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I think I'm understanding your concern. The department already has statutory authority to pursue trespasses and then civil penalty authority, and that's in 273, and then civil penalty authority for violations under 274. Really, we really don't want to use this tool to remove a structure unless it is abandoned. If there is an owner and we provide notice, we would prefer to work with that owner to bring that structure into a working condition and get it authorized to occupy state-owned submersible land. Certainly, the bill with the Dash 1 amendment requires the department to do rulemaking to further delineate that process. Upon a request for a hearing, the afflicted party will have all the protections of the Administrative Procedures Act, and we would follow that due process.
But that's only, if I might, Mr. Chair, that's only as to the size of the penalty, right?
I thought it was to the order, if we were considering this an order.
Well, it'd be an order to give us money.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to take your time. You have a full schedule, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that the Department of State Lands doesn't want to extract money from citizens without process.
Okay.
So we can agree that we have the same goal.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. So I'm going to close the work session on... I can close the work session and reopen again. I'm on the same... I'll table the work session for the moment on House Bill 2463. And let me open a work session on House Bill 3223. I don't know that we really... I'm not going to have Mr. Chandler come up. I'm just going to tell the committee what our amendment basically does. So these, you'll recall, colleagues, this is Mr. Chandler's bill. It has to do with allowing for expedited land divisions. This would create the ability within UGBs to promote more housing that should help with supply issues and affordability and these sorts of things. We have some Dash 2 amendments that I could have him come up and explain if you care to, but he's got consensus from the various people who were worried about it, I think. Who do I got? Where's like 1,000 friends? No, this is no DLCD. That's who he was working with on him. 1,000 friends. Yeah, good. Anybody have anybody else they want me to haul up here on this one? We could have Mr. Chandler come up and explain it if people want.
Can you do that version?
It's been a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I was sitting back there, and I thought you called for the left-hander, and I was disappointed in hearing
you.
That's great. The Dash 2 amendments do two things from the bill we talked about. We talked about what they were going to do in the last hearing. Add some notice provisions for expedited land divisions when an application is submitted to a local government that would fit within the criteria of the bill that they're supposed to tell the applicant, by the way, we can process you in this fashion. And the other thing we did, we talked about this during the testimony last time, is to make this available not just for higher density projects, which is current law, but also the same process available to project properties that would be built, sold, or rented to people making under 120% of median income, so an affordable housing incentive. And in light of other conversations on that general topic that took place earlier today, I think this is a fine bit of public policy and somewhat congruent to have it here in front of you today, if you don't mind my saying so. Glad to take any questions.
Any questions?
No, that was what I needed. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Try for congruence. Thank you so much.
Who's got my...
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 4-10-15.
A Vice Chair Post moves to Dash 2 amendments dated 4-10-15. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3223 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3223 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative
Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hull?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passed and the bill sent to the floor. And it is a Rules Committee bill. I'll carry it. Okay. House Bill. Let me open a work session on House Bill 3274. And this is Representative Wilson's bill about rural technology infrastructure. We have Dash 1 amendments. I forget what they do. Ian, do you?
Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendments simply change, instead of technology infrastructure, it clarifies that it is broadband and telecommunication infrastructure. So it's a little more specific.
So that's the Dash 1s. I opened the work session already. How about motions on the Dash 1?
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-8-15.
Vice Chair Post moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-8-15 to House Bill 3274. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3274 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3274 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any fiscal or subsequent referrals needed?
There's a minimal fiscal.
Minimal fiscal, okay. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll. Oh, sorry.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hull.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes and the bill sent to the floor, and we'll have Representative Wilson carry it. And let me open up a work session on House Bill 2509. Colleagues, this bill is my favorite bill that I have every session relating to the now defunct Aster Experiment Station, which is relevant because it's tied to OSU, but it's relating to agriculture. So what I've got in mind for this bill is the byproduct of our work group on GE conflicts, and I've got Dash 3s that I'm going to ask Farm Bureau, Barry Bichoux, to come up and talk about, and... let's see. There's Ivan. I don't know if Ivan is here. Who else was there? Chris. Well, I can talk about it. And Representative Helm was at some of our meetings, but it conflicted with his other committee. So why don't we talk about these Dash 3 amendments? So do you want to start or do you want me to?
You go ahead.
Okay. So... the work group reached a consensus on these Dash 3 amendments. What they involve is a process for when neighbors are having issues with each other Right now, there is a mediation program at the Department of Agriculture. It is often not used for things like farmers having problems with plants that they or practices they may have that conflict with each other. It's more like labor type issues usually. So what we propose here is that if someone believes they're being infringed on by their neighboring farmer's growing activities, they could request a mediation, and the department would attempt to mediate the problem between the two neighbors. The kind of incentive for someone who's the neighbor, who maybe doesn't know whether they're causing a problem or doesn't believe they've caused a problem, is if they refuse to go to the mediation, or they go and don't act in good faith, and then the person who feels they have been infringed on ends up having to sue them, then if the person sues them after trying mediation and the other party won't come, or comes and doesn't try, Ivan, why don't you come on up? Court would award attorney fees to the party that attempted to mediate if they prevail. So it's an attempt to get at people who are feeling like, I'm got this problem, my neighbor's not responding, we've tried to work it out, I'm going to try and go through the Department of Ag. And the concern was, well, what if the person doesn't want to come because they have the advantage, because they have a crop that is interfering with only in one direction, and there's no risk to them, and they have no reason to want to participate in mediation. So this was the remedy that we sort of came up with. There's another part to it also that has a provision about sampling, that if you're growing a crop and your neighbor is growing something that you believed infringed on you, you might very well get a sample taken for your own purposes to prove you got infringed on and cross-pollinated, for example. When your neighbor comes on, and then the neighbor wants to take their own sample to see whether they believe you, that they really did infringe on their land, the landowner would have the right to have the Department of Ag be present during the sampling to make sure they don't literally plant something that, it's like a chain of custody issue to make sure that the sampling is being done appropriately. So the neighboring person who is being accused of interfering with the property owner could come on and get a sample, but the Department of Ag would be present for it. I think those are the two main provisions of the bill. I might be forgetting something. So, tell us about your feelings about these dash threes.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to come talk about the bill. I'm actually here to support the bill on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation and the work that we've done regarding this number of issues. Frankly, it's based around the issue of coexistence, not something new. We believe that generations of farmers have worked collaboratively across their fences and in their communities to try and...
We need your name. Sorry,
Barry. I'm sorry. Barry Bichou. I'm sorry. And I currently serve as the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau. The United States Department of Agriculture and APHIS have spent an inordinate amount of time nationally to develop methods and standards for coexistence, and they've done that through the AC21 committee at the request of the Secretary of Agriculture, which I was fortunate to serve on. Just as late as last month, I attended a meeting in North Carolina on coexistence to talk about these very issues, so I'm particularly pleased to see that this bill has a reference in there to the work that's already done and referring that through Oregon State and Extension to help farmers overcome some of the challenges they may see with their neighbors. I think our opinion is that that a lot of the anecdotes out there to talk about the challenges between one farmer and another are frankly largely anecdotal. And we're pleased to see that this approach to having neighbors have a framework and a provision through which they can sit down and have safe discussions at the request of one or another of them, and deal with the professionals at the Oregon Department of Agriculture Mediation Service to give them a set of parameters through which they can actually try and deal with the challenges they may see with regard to different types of crops. We think this is highly preferable to any types of mandates or practices which make a preference for one type of crop over another. And we've always had challenges with with that. I think it's a challenge for our industry. It's clearly a challenge for policymakers to get drug into the middle of it, and we think that this mediation program will provide a background and a baseline to determine what actual type of conflicts are there. Do they exist? If they do exist, what format are they taking, and how well the Department of Agriculture, working collaboratively with those growers, are able to help assist in some of these coexistence matters. So we're awfully thankful to Chair Clem for putting together a work group with a plethora of bills that were very wide-ranging, some of them mandated bills, some of them voluntary bills, and I didn't envy his task then of trying to bring all that together, and I think he did a great job of trying to come to some solution and weave his way through the maze of things that were the various proposals. And so I thank him for that, and I just want to again state our support for the Dash 3s, and look forward to seeing how things go in the future with that as a background. I think it's a great opportunity to see whether or not there is the kind of challenges that are purported, and it provides for a great opportunity to see where they are, what they are, and if this body at some stage hopefully won't have to readdress some of these issues, but at least it gives us a framework to do so. And once again, I think a lot of credit goes to Chair Clem, and it's all yours, Ivan.
All right. For the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. I'd like to thank Representative Clem as well for taking this bill that is very close to his heart regarding the defunct Astor Experiment Station and allowing it to be used for this work group product. As Barry mentioned, you know, we talked about a lot of contentious legislative ideas around genetic engineering during our work group process. As you had heard in previous testimony, a number of us, Barry and myself included, had been on the governor's task force on genetic engineering to address issues around coexistence. And so I will say that this bill definitely creates a pathway for mediated discussions around some of these coexistence conflicts, and that's a good thing. In and of itself, we do think the state there is a larger role for the Oregon Department of Agriculture in these conversations generally. We hope that there will be other legislation to tackle some of those issues, but in terms of creating the conversations that need to happen when they're not otherwise easily happening, this mediation concept both provides an incentive and a pathway for important conversations to happen in coexistence. Frankly, conflicts are occurring, and how to make sure that folks can come away with as little harm as possible. So, thank you.
Any questions for these gentlemen?
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, who's got some dash threes? We're giving them all to the vice chair with the voice because the other one doesn't have much of a voice today.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 4-10-15.
Vice Chair Post moves the Dash 3 amendments dated 4-10-15. Is there discussion? This is a gut and stuff. We are not deleting the reference to the Astor Experiment Station. I want to have the reference on the books for next session. So, any objections to the amendment? Any further discussion? Any objections? Dash 3s are adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2509 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2509 to the floor with as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative McClain.
Given the way in which this bill has arrived here, has there been opposition on file? Has anyone put anything in OLIS in opposition? I can't find.
No.
Is there anyone that you know of opposed to it?
No. Everybody in the work group reached a consensus. So that involved Farm Bureau, Oregon Food and Shelter, Oregon Tilth. I wouldn't call the Department of Agriculture allowed to take positions one way or the other, but and the governor's office. And then Senators Hansel, Thompson, Dembro, and then I was really the only House member who could be there every time, but Vice Chair Helm was there other times, and I think that's pretty much everybody.
Okay.
No opposition from any of those parties.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Crawford?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Whip?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hull?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Klum?
Aye. Motion passes. The bill is sent to the floor. And, I'm trying to think if there's anybody else who's been involved with this. I think I will entertain the option of Representative Buckley. I think it was his bills that led to the task force carrying it. If he doesn't want to, then I'll carry it. Okay. Now, let's go to, we'll come back to derelict structures here in a little while. Let's get our public hearing going on House Bill. I'm going to open both House Bills 2722 and 3531 and ask Ian and Joel both to come up. Let's do House Bill 2722 first. Or Joel, if you need to, you can just do them both together for time purposes.
Maybe talk about both of them together.
Okay. And so I'll open one. I'll open a public hearing also on House Bill 3531.
All right, Chair Klim, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association representing over 275 members all across Oregon, big and small. I'd like to state for the record, Brian Klim and I did both, the chair did both coordinate our outfits today. Mm-hmm. We often do.
I'm an urban hipster. No, not really.
So this bill, this idea has kind of been kicking around for a while. It started for us a little over a year ago. We were doing some economic research showing that, during the Great Recession in 2008, almost all industry sectors across Oregon and across the United States took a big nosedive, except for food and beverage in Oregon. So this graph is showing you that. That black line shows that big dip. The red line is food and beverage in Oregon. We kept kind of sailing right through. And that's, again, showing the job growth during the recession. This is another one. This is food manufacturing without beverage. Shows that we're steadily increasing there. The red line, again, is Oregon. And here we go, food manufacturing and beverage manufacturing, red being Oregon and the U.S. So we're seeing that this is comparing food and beverage across the U.S. and in Oregon. So we have some comparative advantages in Oregon. We're doing some things right, that there is perceived quality here in Oregon that people are willing to pay for. We see that, very real, that shows up in the price of Oregon wine, commanding twice the price of wine from California or from Washington. Little known fact, Oregon used to be the biggest producer of mint in the United States and was steadily commanding a price that was about 20% higher anywhere else because of the quality of our mint. So we put together a big group of people, people that had probably never totally been together before. You've got people like A to Z Wine Works, you've got breweries, you've got Tillamook Creamery, Dave's Killer Bread, food, beverage, liquor, everybody sitting down talking about what are things that we can do to capitalize on the success. We've got a whole lot of ideas. We've talked to this committee about some of that work in the past. I've submitted some testimony that details a whole slew of other bills that we've put together on things that help us get there on this. Today we're talking specifically about the idea of either brand Oregon or certified Oregon. And the idea there was, is there something that we can do to create a certification and then market that to really capitalize on that value that we have here in Oregon? So we put together a work group. We've talked a lot about what those certifications might be, doing some sort of quality standards and or sustainability standards. And what we came up with was we need more time to flesh that idea out. So that's the bill you see before you in House Bill 2722. It would say, let's put together a work group to decide if we should do a certification, if it's just place-based, if we have some quality standards, if there are sustainability standards, what those are, or do we even want to do that? If we want to do anything, we will. If we do a certification, we for sure would need to spend some time and money marketing that. So that's the other piece of House Bill 2722, which we pulled out and put in House Bill 3531, is just the marketing component. So House Bill 3531, we've discussed this with both Business Oregon and the Department of Agriculture. They feel that the right place would be the Department of Agriculture for them to discuss doing some marketing, developing sort of a brand image around Oregon that already is, you know, kind of there but could be capitalized on, and then focusing those dollars internationally. The global middle class right now is about 1 billion people. It's set to grow to somewhere between 2 billion and 3 billion people by the year 2030, most of that happening in Asia and India, and we are, you know, geographically in a good location to be exporting there. So the idea that we've discussed with the Northwest Food Processors Association, the Department of Agriculture, would be focusing those dollars internationally. We're not quite sure, you know, how much the Department of Agriculture is actually putting together. I think it's still in the process of putting together sort of a menu they could show you of, you know, here's what $1 million would buy, here's what $2 million would buy, here's what $5 million would buy. But the idea would probably be, let's do a little bit of a market analysis, see where we, you know, we've got some traction already, and focus on, you know, one specific region and one of these markets where we, you know, $1 million or $2 million or $5 million could really go a long way rather than spreading that money out globally. So with that, I will take any questions or turn it over to Ian.
And you kind of covered both bills, didn't you?
A little bit, yeah. So, the 2722 is mostly just the certification part. We had a relating to clause issue, and we weren't able to put in there that we want to expend monies on marketing, or it was a little wishy-washy. And the Northwest Food Processors had expressed some concern. I'll let them talk in a minute about the certification development of that. So House Bill 3531 would be just funding for this marketing and branding component.
Okay, great. Any questions for Joel? I know you've got to go. So you want to stick around?
Yeah, I can stick around.
All right, sorry about that. Ian, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ian Tollison with the Northwest Food Processors Association. Just want to say, you know, the work that was first started by Oregon Business Association and us with the Food and Beverage Leadership Council, I think, goes to a goal we certainly want to see more emphasis put on. About 80% of all ag products in the state are shipped out of state. Of that number, about half is out of country. We are an export state, and we are positioned extremely well next to the Pacific Rim to get our products to those markets. I think the intent here is to help expand upon that, which we need. We face significant pressures from other states attracting food processing business. We experience pressure from other countries that are putting a lot more investment into these facilities. So it's a very competitive industry that we live in. We oppose House Bill 2722 because of the certification standards in there. I was at a food processing plant a few weeks ago, and I was talking to the plant manager, and I just casually asked him about how many people come in and certify your plant in a given year. And his answer was about 25 or 30. This is ranges from government agencies to their customers. People are always coming in, certifying, looking at sustainability, labor issues, both on-farm and in the food processing plant. Any additional standards or certification process would really be a little too cumbersome for us in this competitive market. However, there is a thread there that I think is worthwhile in helping us get into more market access, and that is the bill that you will see in House Bill 3501, which we do support. I think because we are in such a competitive industry, we need to get all resources available to help leverage a lot of the marketing missions that ODA does in conjunction with USDA. And if there's any way possible that we can get more help for value-added and raw agricultural products, The Oregon farmer, the Oregon food processor, employee, the Oregon consumer, all of us will greatly benefit. And so we are in support of 3501, but are in opposition to 2722. Thank you.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Your comments, your visuals, and the partnership with 3531 all relate to agriculture, but the bill, the initial bill, 2722, doesn't reference agriculture alone. Is this an ag promotion project, or can it apply to any Oregon products?
So yeah, this is focused on food, on processed foods, value-added food, and agriculture. So at this time, it would not apply to all Oregon products.
And, Mr. Chair, follow-up?
The second bill. The first one did apply to everything, the second as you mentioned. Yeah, it's my bill. The one that Ian opposes. Yeah, did you have a follow-up?
I'm good. Thanks.
Speaking of which, what standards in here? What line? What are the standards you don't like?
Mr. Chair, I think that's the problem. It doesn't have any. And exactly. they're believed to be left up into another group down the road. And I think that's a dangerous precedent for agriculture to have.
So the problem isn't so much the standards, it's the fear of what they might be.
Yes. Gotcha. We have no idea. That bill gives us no vision into what that would look like or how we would help really shape that and have an input. And if, you know, putting that on top of all the many other certifications, whether it's GAP or whatever, it becomes a little onerous. And I'm concerned that with the competition with our surrounding states trying to get food processing plants there, that they'll vote with their feet. And that's what I don't want to see happen here in Oregon.
So colleagues, just for your benefit, this is why Joel's point that we need more time to actually hash this out. The kinds of things that are the round, there is a thing called Certified South Carolina. They already beat us to the punch, it turns out. All that certifies is essentially that it was grown in South Carolina. That's the certification, is that it actually came from South Carolina. That would probably be acceptable to people. But I believe we would have some problems from the environmental community that's not enough, that's implying the use of the word certification that usually has some greater sustainability meaning and doesn't have enough teeth. So that was the sort of place we got stuck. Where this is, even though it would be voluntary, nobody would have to use the label if they didn't want to. Industry, I think, is nervous about what kinds of certification requirements might come back, even on a voluntary program. And the lowest common denominator we could get to wasn't probably satisfactory, so we decided to shelve it for this session and instead work on this other bill, House Bill 3531, about marketing these agricultural products. I'm sure we'll be back to talk about certified Oregon at some point, but not in the context of just sending the OBDD off to come up with something and then enact it. At a bare minimum, we would probably have, you know, a report back on what they came up with, and then we'd have to decide at that point what to do with it.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, yep. You know, a lot of our members, they produce food with very well-known names that have been around for 100 years throughout the country. And I would submit to you that sometimes those names are a little bit more powerful than Oregon. It just depends on what market that is. I think that the emphasis of these bills is to sell more of our products, which is great. Completely want to see more of that. It's just how best to get there and if the actual processor is going to use a label or not. Because if we're going to put money into a system that's not used, I would be a little concerned about that. And I would think that our money is best spent to try to open up other markets and other opportunities for our food processing businesses.
Which reminds me, actually, and this is for Representative Gomberg more than anybody probably. I remember the original concept of this bill was to apply for any business. And actually, frankly, our hope was that you could get the bigger brands that already have huge international names to put the fact that they're from Oregon on their packaging. That was my original. The entire reason I came up with this was seeing so many Nike and Columbia sportswear stores and boxes all over the world that didn't say where their headquarters are from. So it was, could we come up with something that would coax them into leveraging their marketing dollars and brands to say they're from Oregon? So that's where Certified Oregon originally came from, was could we ask, you know, could we make it attractive enough that people would want to use it? Because obviously they don't need to say they're from Oregon for people to know what Nike is, but could we talk Nike into wanting to put Oregon on there? And we eventually devolved into just ag and then now to ag products. So we'll come back another time, but that's the genesis of the bill. Okay, any further questions? Representative Gilliam, did you want to grill Ian on why he opposes your bill as well?
I didn't.
He had a pretty good response.
I wasn't aware that he was
very compelling testimony.
It was very compelling. Okay, we got to move on. So thank you. Just thank you, gentlemen. Let me close the public hearing on House Bills 2722 and House Bill 3531. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3531. And colleagues, for those of you who weren't here, this is the one that they both support. The other bill, they didn't. One liked it, the other not so much into it. Well, the one would say liked it. One wants more discussion. The other, I don't know if he wants it dead forever or not. But so that one we're not doing anything with. That would be my bill that we're killing. And then this would be the consensus bill.
So, Mr. Chair, you're opening a work session on 3531.
I'm trying to.
And the notes say here we can't have a work session before.
I think that's meant to apply to the other one, down below it, 2508.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
My mistake. I apologize.
So this, colleagues, this is the one that has the Department of Ag develop and establishing a program to create marketing plans for value-added Oregon agricultural products. And that was the food processors and the Oregon Business Association's food leadership, food something. What's it called? Oregon Food Beverage Leadership Council. Just up here testifying in support of this. Any discussion? Oh, wait. I need a motion.
Okay. Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3531 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3531 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that I stepped out. The bills are related. Did you just hold 2722 over?
No, I'm killing it.
You're killing it.
I'm killing our bill.
That's great. You know, you could at least tell me.
Oh,
we could have a wait. We could.
Yeah, okay, something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg?
Oh, the Cheese District votes yes.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hull?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Plum?
Aye. Motion passes. Bill sent to Ways and Means. Okay. We've got two more bills of people waiting a long time to do, so I'm going to do the shorter one first and open a public hearing on House Bill 3520. And ask Mr. Mannix and whoever, if you have somebody with you, to come on up. Eric? Maybe?
Fruits.
Eric Fruits? Should say former Representative Mannix, who had my district three before me or something like that.
Five terms, Mr. Chairman.
I'm in my fifth. I don't know if I'm going to, I don't think I'm going to beat your record if I keep having performances like today in these orange pants.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney in town. I'm here in my capacity as president of Common Sense for Oregon. And I happen to have, and I wore many times as a state representative, a navy blue and orange tie similar to yours, but so many people misconstrued my Virginia tie to be an Oregon State University tie that I avoid wearing it at the Capitol, especially at Oregon State University Day, with due deference to all of our friends at the Oregon State University. In any event, I'm here today with Eric Fruits, who will introduce himself in a moment and speak to this bill. House Bill 3520 was presented to you as a priority bill from Representative Kenemer, who has very nicely allowed me to speak on his behalf and on behalf of this bill. The bill is meant to address our land use system
and to simply further the purposes of the land use system as we have envisioned it and as we hope we have practiced it. It is meant to ensure that, as I wrote to the individual members of this committee, a deal is a deal. When you go through the process of establishing regionally significant industrial lands and you specify certain land as regionally significant industrial land, you should then carry forward with that deal so that the property owners who've participated in this process, they've seen the designation, can rely on that in their long-term planning. It has a significant impact on our capability as a state for economic development, for industrial development, for us to continue to have those lands available. And as Dr. Fruits will explain, that process is an important process. We've gone through it so that we're protecting farmland, we've got our rural areas where different uses are recognized adjacent to farmland. We have our suburban areas, urban areas. We've also said it's important to have industrial development in the state. Let's designate those lands. This bill simply says when a unit of local government subsequently decides that they want to do something to restrict the industrial land, they should get the consent of the property owners. If they don't want the consent of the property owners or they can't get the consent of the property owners, they still have condemnation power. But we've made it clear that if the condemnation power is to be used, that the just compensation is the reduction in value of that entire parcel of industrial land. If you restrict the land in such a way that you can't build that factory, and you've only restricted part of the land, but you were going to have a factory, say, on 50 acres, and now you can only have a factory on 20 acres, you have reduced value on the entire parcel of land, not just the area that you've restricted. So this is meant to be a common-sense, long-term protection so that when people go through this process of designating regionally significant industrial lands, they can depend on it, just as farmers ought to be able to depend on the designation of agricultural land, or those who have got commercial districts can depend on that. We've said as a state, we've got a statutory process. Let's implement it. This bill simply says we need some additional protection for those property owners. Now, I've seen the letter from the city of Wilsonville saying we've got this great project going, regionally significant industrial lands, and we've got these other things we want to do that might end up in changing and restricting some of the use of these lands. That's great. Frankly, that kind of project that they've described will probably increase the value of the property. The property owners ought to love the city of Wilsonville for doing it. But if there is a property owner who says, wait a minute, I was going to build a factory here, and I think what you want to do is just great, but it doesn't fit my plans, the city of Wilsonville can still go forward, but they have to pay for what they're taking. That's all this bill says. Pay for what you're taking if you can't get consent on a deal that has already been made. It respects property rights. It respects the opportunity for industrial development. It also respects the opportunity of local government to change that deal if they want to, but to pay for it. And I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Fruits, if I may.
Please.
Thank you. Chairman Clem, members of the committee, my name is Eric Fruits. Some of you know me. I'm a Portland area economist. I have a PhD in economics. I've taught real estate finance courses. I've taught urban economics. I've helped put together a real estate finance textbook. I'm also the editor of the Portland State University Quarterly Report, which is a quarterly report on Oregon real estate trends. So I know quite a bit about real estate and urban economics and zoning and so forth. And so I'm here to testify about House Bill 3520. I'll give a little background how an economist thinks about zoning, and because a lot of times we just think of zoning as something that's out there in the books. The reason why we came up with the whole concept of zoning to begin with is to separate what we call incompatible uses. In other words, you don't want to have a factory right next to a house. And so when we, the idea of these separating these incompatible uses is to reduce what are known as externalities or spillovers, negative spillovers. And when we think about industrial zoning, we tend to think about the negative spillovers from industry. And they are there. You know, there's things like noise and traffic and vibrations and so forth. But also there's other incompatibilities, too. It's a way of keeping other uses out of those industrial areas. You couldn't imagine putting a skateboard park in the middle of an industrial area because of all the danger, because of the danger of the skateboarders among all that traffic. And so it really works both ways. There's negative spillovers from the recreational uses or from housing uses, as well as negative spillovers from the industrial uses. So that's our framework for having a zoning system, and it's been adopted in almost every place in the U.S. except for Houston, right? Now let's fast forward and talk about the regionally significant industrial areas. So that's a special kind of industrial zoning, and it's not just a fancy term. It's actually written into Oregon state law. It's known as regionally significant industrial areas. And those regionally significant industrial areas are special. They're industrial areas that are located to the region's most significant transportation networks. They're designed to get essentially manufactured goods from the manufacturer out into the distribution system. And so that's what makes them regionally significant. And so they're special, and Oregon state law gave them special protections. They were designed so that you couldn't put in new kinds of zoning overlays that may allow other uses. The way that regionally significant industrial areas were developed is through a very involved public process where they're identified, you have public input, and then they're set into motion. And the rules governing those and the protections, again, have been developed through a very rigorous public process. We've seen in a few cases now where we've had some local governments that have tried to roll back those protections. In the metro area, the area run by Portland or the Portland area regional government, there's been successful attempts to put recreational uses within those areas. Wilsonville has an idea of maybe taking that industrial and moving it more to a tech, so it's not really necessarily manufacturing, but more high tech. That's inconsistent with the industrial use, but that really highlights how this measure provides protections and the ability to flexibly use industrial areas. For the metro example, if Metro wanted to take that land from people and make that land worth less as an industrial use, they could pay for that use to put a trailhead within an industrial area. If, for example, Wilsonville wants to transfer their industrial area into a tech park, they could go to those business owners, those property owners, and say, look, we've got a great idea. And those property owners would most likely sign up for it. And so you would actually have them willingly sign up for it. So what we have here is really a very modest proposal. It's so modest that it really just kind of codifies what was the original intent of the law that established the regionally significant industrial areas and protects those promises that we've made through a very involved public process. I've done some work on this before involving the metro issue, and so if you want me, I can, under Q&A framework, give you some more specifics if you need those.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yeah.
I'd like to add, this bill is not about a specific case. It's not about Metro. It's not about a particular city. I mentioned the city of Wilsonville because I saw the letter that they sent to you. I just wanted to address that issue. I know that the League of Oregon Cities and 1,000 Friends of Oregon will be testifying this afternoon. I'm certainly interested in hearing about their objections, and if there's a need for modifications, I'm very happy to talk to them about it. As you know, this is a priority bill that came in late, so there hasn't been as much opportunity for a lot of discussion on these issues, and we certainly want to address any concerns that may be technical concerns about the bill, but I think the principle of the bill is simple and straightforward. A deal is a deal. We've been through this process. Let's protect the rights of those who participated in this process and had an agreement.
Any question for these gentlemen? Representative Witt.
Gentlemen, I applaud your efforts, and I think this is important to move forward in this. I'm worried about that. That very rare instance where the federal government, subsequent to a listing here of regionally significant industrial area, decides that part of that area is critical habitat, and a local government, in order to forestall a federally imposed recovery plan, would like to implement some kind of local effort. That could be very well to the detriment of someone who owns industrial land, and there would be no incentive for that individual economically to abide by the locally thought out recovery plan.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I think that was a comment as well as a question.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, in response to that, that is actually a concern that we had not had brought to us. And I think that a limitation could be put into this legislation to allow local government to respond to the heavy hand of the federal government or the light hand in certain situations. And we could put an exclusion clause that would allow local government to respond to that kind of critical situation.
It would be a very rare occurrence.
Further questions? Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Alfred from Metro, Aaron Doyle from League of Oregon Cities, and Mary Kyle McCurdy up. Oh. Steve, did you want to testify, or we have Mary Kyle's online?
You have Mary Kyle's.
Okay. Steve Kafori.
Now,
yeah, please. Okay, and Roger or Aaron, who I, Aaron, you're first on my list.
Chair Klemmer, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle on behalf of League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to be brief because I think much of what my concerns are related to some of the things that were raised by the city of Wilsonville about flexibility in local overlays to create incentivizing particular types of industry to come in. I think that Tech Park is actually considered industrial lands. I'm trying to go back into the regionally significant industrial lands statute, but my computer skills are not as fast as I need them to be right now. A couple of other issues. I think that the way that the regionally significant designation occurs is through cooperation between landowners and local governments in the state to create these areas that are going to be preserved in industrial land for 10 years at a minimum. That is the requirement under the law currently. And if local governments feel that they suddenly lose the ability to do any planning without consulting a particular property owner as opposed to the entirety of the constituency that they represent, it will disincentivize the local governments from using this program. Because part of what we do as a local government is long-term planning. And we do that with hopes of creating the best economic outcomes for our location. And if we're going to give up the ability to plan in an area by siting it for 10 years and putting it out pretty much out of changes, simple beyond overlays, there's no incentive for us to use this program if we can't continue to do our planning meet our planning obligations. I think Senate Bill 766 was well balanced in its attempt to preserve industrial lands for industrial uses and create a sense of certainty for the properties at issue. If you look at the areas that have been designated, there's only 5 to 15 that are allowed at any one time at the statewide level. I can't really speak to Metro's program. I don't know it, but I'm very concerned that if we don't have this type of requirement that we turn to the property owner that might be affected by every planning decision that we make, and if we're specializing or specifically turning to these particular property owners, we're providing them an incentive or an advantage that no other property owner in the city gets. We also have federal requirements about takings. We have Measure 49 claims. There are a number of ways that folks can come after us if we truly do devalue their land by our planning process. And I think that those tools are sufficient at this point. By asking us to seek permission from one owner, we are not working to the benefit of the community, provided that we've already worked with them in having these areas designated as these regional industrial sites. And we're already required to preserve them for industrial uses. It might be that there's a disagreement about what type of industry should be placed there. And some, for example, I'm going to turn to the city of Wilsonville because they've provided the most robust statement. If they're looking to incentivize particular types of industry, because that's what their workforce is going to be able to provide, and that's the type of high wage jobs that they want to provide, I think that that's important. And that overlay zone is a public policy that a public government entity is making. And by saying one landowner can say, no, I don't care about the overall economic development in an area, I think that that sets bad public policy. And for that reason, we oppose this bill as written, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Post, members of the committee. Roger Alfred, I'm an attorney with Metro Regional Government. I'll be pretty brief. This bill just came to our attention recently, obviously, because it just came up. And we have spent the last couple of days looking at it and trying to figure out exactly what it's aimed at and what it does. And it's not entirely clear, but it caught our attention for two reasons. One is that, as has been stated, Metro is in charge of mapping the regionally significant industrial areas in the metropolitan region. So that mapping exercise is something that we undertake to protect industrial uses throughout the metro region. The other reason it really caught our attention is because it is, frankly, incredibly broadly written. The language of this bill, the key part of the language is that it essentially says local governments, which would include Metro, cannot restrict industrial use. And if there is a restriction of industrial use, then the requirements kick in about obtaining property owner consent, and if you can't get consent, then it becomes a taking. What this does is essentially apply to basically any planning decision that is made by any city or metro as it affects industrial land. As this is demonstrated by the letter that has been submitted by the city of Wilsonville, what Wilsonville is trying to do is simply adopt some design requirements for an employment area, architectural design requirements, and those would trigger this because that does create a restriction on industrial use. Similar restrictions on industrial use would include the adoption of rules regarding hours of operation, height limits, noise restrictions, even parking requirements. So if a local government came in and said, you know, we want to make sure that there's enough parking, we're going to create a requirement where, you know, for every employee that's going to exist, you have to provide one parking space, something to that effect. That is a restriction on industrial use that would trigger the provisions of this bill. So to hear Dr. Fruit's comment that this is a modest proposal, I would submit is not entirely accurate, because this would have huge and far-reaching ramifications. I think it's very broadly written, and if this bill, as we suspect, is perhaps intended to apply to some more specific issue, I submit that maybe the bill should be redrafted so that it actually applies to that issue. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I represent the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, land use planners, land use lawyers, and citizen planning commission members. We oppose the bill. The present law already requires local government regulation to mitigate by providing additional lands and preserving essential characteristics of the industrial area. Nothing is served by imposing these additional draconian measures. Secondly, land use planning works best when it serves the public at large and not just the individual private owners. Three, local government and metro, as we just heard, would be less likely to support these areas in places that contain natural resources out of fear that the necessary consent is not secured, valuable resources could be lost. The result would be that fewer of these areas would be created and not more. Finally, we've learned our lesson from ballot measure 37 that allowing economic recovery resulting from regulations that diminish value is a moving target that helps only lawyers and appraisers who can spend time fighting about it at the cost of the taxpayer, property owner, and this process itself. We oppose the bill.
Questions for this committee? Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. This is a question for Roger. My distant memory is that once regionally significant industrial lands are identified, that as perhaps part of the regional framework plan or functional plan, that cities and counties are required thereafter to amend their plans to be consistent. Can you help the committee understand what that means and whether that carries with it specific restrictions for that industrial land as might pertain to an individual land use application?
Thank you. Yes, Chair Clem, Representative Helm, the answer to the first part of your question is yes, you're correct. So as part of the process that Metro undergoes to map the industry, regionally significant industrial lands, we also have a number of requirements that apply to those lands. Those requirements do not themselves apply directly. What they do is they require the local governments that have regionally significant industrial lands in their jurisdictions to amend their own plans and codes to comply with those. And yes, those do include, you know, some fairly specific restrictions, mostly designed to protect industrial uses on those lands. So, for example, there are some restrictions on the ability to put commercial uses in industrial lands. That's kind of the prime example, something that we saw a lot of was that really great industrial land was often being turned into big box retail. Part of what the Metro restrictions do is say, hey, these are industrial lands, they should stay industrial and not be turned into large commercial uses.
Question. Thank you. Representative Witt.
Roger, admittedly, the bill may have broader reach than we thought at first blush. Were that to be tightened up, could you support the bill at that point?
Well, we would, Representative Witt, Chair Clem, we would, of course, need to see, you know, whatever the language would be. It's hard for me to imagine that we would support something that included the same kind of restrictions here where individual property owners have to be consulted to the extent that there are going to be any restrictions placed on their property. I mean, that's, from our perspective, I think that would be a little bit of a reach, and I suspect the cities might agree. But again, we would be willing to see any proposed changes that came up and would be happy to comment on them.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the fact that you would at least look at any rewrite. But I have to disagree with the defensive posture of this panel. To me, you talk about it being broadly written. The bill is broadly written. It's restrictive of, I think, of the folks that you represent. And it reaffirms property rights of individual businesses, particularly industrial. And I can't say that bothers me. The restrictive nature of land use planning in our state and in the cities, I think, screams for somebody to say industrial is not a dirty word. We depend on it. And I think we need to respect individual property owners at all levels, including industrial. So the defensiveness and the criticism of the bill does not ring true with me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3520 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2508. Colleagues, some of you may have to go, and so no offense to any of the people here if they end up having other appointments. But we have several people who are here from 100 miles or more, so I at least want to get through those. J.R. Cook, Tim Tippett, and Don Rice. And they'll tell you about the bill, but this is, again, a bill I have no recollection right at the moment for what the contents of the bill were, but it relates to the use of land, relating to the use of land. And so we have some folks here to talk to us about what they would like to take this bill and do with it, which is not what the bill originally did. This would be what we call gut and stuff if we go forward. So tell us about what you would like to do with the use of land.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, Vice Chair Helm, J.R. Cook, representing the Northeast Oregon Water Association. First off, I want to thank Chair Clem for offering to hear this bill tonight. It's been quite a ride for our region in terms of addressing some issues that you will hear that are going to be hopefully addressed as part of this this legislative gut and stuff. We've been working in our region first, a little bit about now. We represent over 140,000 acres of probably the most highly productive food production land in Northeast Oregon, especially, as well as the counties, the ports, the businesses that make up the $2 billion per year value chain of the value-added industry that supports our rural economy. So in our region, maintenance of that small land base is very critical to growing and enhancing our rural economy. As you know, value-added agriculture is our mainstay. It keeps us rolling, and you're going to hear more about that from Mr. Rice to my left and Mr. Tippett to my right, as well as Jeff Bosma, who's going to come up here after us. We worked with the Farm Bureau specifically after over 6 years of trying to deal with a very real issue and a very real potential impact to our region. As you know, we're situated along the Columbia River. The electrical grid just so happens to fall along the Columbia River due to the fact that there just happens to be dams there. And now that we are in the era of renewable energy production and partnerships to convey energy from one location to the other, we're seeing a very significant a host of proposed transmission lines running through our most significant high-value farmland trying to reach the grid. We took a stab as a region of attempting to address this issue primarily with the Idaho Power Boardman to Hemingway line. That's a partnership amongst other utility providers to try to route that line to the south of our high-value farmland, thereby allowing energy production and energy transmission to move forward, as well as protect our irreplaceable high-value farmland that people have made significant investments in support industries and industrial development around it. Unfortunately for us, we're a bunch of farmers, landowners, businessmen, and we're dealing with entities that have a process behind them through the Energy Facility Siting Council, in some cases a federal process, and in all cases the power of eminent domain. And so the ability to negotiate with these organizations like you would a normal business activity is a little bit difficult for us. So what we wanted to do in identifying the issue was put some legal sideboards on how we could plan for corridors and efforts that would enable us to plan with the Department of Energy, the utilities, and our region to find some routes that we could memorialize by law that would enable energy providers to get around or through us, and everybody's happy. Unfortunately, that doesn't currently exist, and the permitting processes are continuing forward both at the local or at the state level through FSEC and at the federal level, and we're very concerned. We believe that this might just be a local concern or a regional concern, so we approached the Farm Bureau, and in doing so, they worked with us, as this isn't just a regional concern. There's some other areas that are experiencing the same with their impact potential, and we crafted Senate Bill 873 this year and dropped it on the Senate side. Was a very quick, we believe, fix. We thought it was common sense that prior to an application to FSEC or local government, which is required of any transmission line, that an alternatives analysis be developed by the applicant that would show alternatives to routing energy facilities or transmission across high-value farmland. It wasn't a moratorium. What it did was it defined high-value farmland. It required an alternatives analysis as part of the application. If that alternative analysis was deemed to show that they had to cross high-value farmland, it would require an impact, or would require that the applicant minimize impacts through probably 40 years of 40 years of case law that defines what minimized impacts or changes in farm use mean under land use law. So that bill now is in front of you is the -1 amendments to 2508. We've been working with the governor's office on trying to find an amicable solution to the issue. We believe that some legal sideboards are necessary due to two things. One, again, we're an area that values itself on collaboration, where we work with other developers or impacts before those impacts are realized. In this case, we can't guarantee that that collaboration is going to be reciprocal in terms of the investment that's been made in our region and hopefully what will continue to be made with some of the work we're doing with you fine folks on water issues, et cetera. This issue, we think, deserves consideration now. We've, as we have said, we've worked on it for years. We need a fix to this issue, both in our region, I believe, and some other regions, to be able to bring us to the table in a fashion that has some legal sideboards that allows us to plan and actually develop an amicable solution without the threat of somebody running over the top of you. So with that being said, I'm just going to do a brief presentation, knowing there's some people that want to testify. These folks have had to travel farther than I have, so I'll pass over the baton to Don Rice to my left and let him explain a little bit about specifics of the impact. So thanks for the chance to testify. I hope that clarifies.
Hold on one quick second, because we may have some members who need to leave, and I need to get a rule suspension to allow a member to vote, and that takes more than just the normal quorum. So let me recess or table the public hearing on the use of land, whatever, which one was it? Oh, yeah, House Bill 2508, and entertain a motion to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Representative McClain to vote on House Bill 2633.
Yes, exactly what you just said. Oh, I have to say all that?
Actually, I don't think so.
Okay.
So moved? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Vice Chair Post moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative McClain to vote on House Bill 2633. Is there any objection? Seeing none, would the clerk please take the vote?
Representative McClain?
No.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Let me reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2508.
Thank you, Chairman Clem, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Don Rice. I work for Greenwood Boardman Tree Farm. If you traveled up Interstate 84 from Boardman to Hermiston and seen the trees along the highway there, that's the farm that I'm associated with. And you might notice as you travel around that typically trees and power lines are somewhat incompatible. And so proposed power transmission lines through the tree farm basically take the land out of production in total. So I guess just like to give a quick example of the process.
I'm terribly sorry. I'm just, before I lose members, I've got one more thing I need to do.
Please.
Okay, let me recess table for the moment the public hearing in House Bill 2508. I didn't think we had the paperwork on the dash one amendment to 3212, but we do. So let me open a work session on House Bill 3212. Colleagues, this is a bill we heard about a while ago. It has a dash one amendment. The dash one amendment is referring to the term regulate in the original bill. And the original bill, it says restrict a farming practice. This would change it to regulate a farming practice. It broadens the definition a little bit for farmers who believe that they have had a restriction that devalued their land. We did have some testimony from the Department of Ag about how it might affect things like livestock quarantine districts. And I had some input from the governor's office about potentially what it would mean for marijuana as well. I haven't been able to get any responses to requests because of busy schedules for actual amendments, just sort of concerns. So I at least proposing that we adopt it, and if we need to pull back some of the things like quarantine zones and other things, that we do that in the Senate. But I want the protections for the farmers moving forward. And when I have a hard time getting people to respond to requests for amendments and or information, I'm not sure what else to do. So that's the dash one amendment. Changes the term restrict from the original bill to regulate. That would make it align exactly with the forestry provisions, and those were done, as you may recall, in 2009. We made clear that any restriction on forestry practices would make people eligible for waiver or compensation. This would align ag practices in the exact same way as forestry. So that's House Bill 3212 and the dash ones. I'd take a motion if we had it.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 3/16/15.
Vice Chair Helms moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3212 dated 3/16/15. Is there any objection to the Dash 1s? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3212 with the amendments, with the amendment with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3212 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gompert.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hull.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill sent to the floor. I'll carry it. And before I lose a quorum, is it? I totally understand. I think I do too, actually. Is there anything that I need to keep a quorum for carrying over? We have a quorum. You two are okay. For carrying over?
Just the public hearings from today.
Do I need a quorum to carry over?
I don't think so. I can carry it.
Why don't while we're here, why don't we do our carryovers? Then we'll go back to our hearing. I'm very sorry. So what I have left is we're killing 2729. No, it's fine. Killed 2722. We're in 2508, so we can deal with that at the end of this. 3212 we just finished. 3379 and 3416, I don't have authorization to move to the Rules Committee, so those are going to go away. And what's that? Tina told me now, so. So I could, and then have that conversation again. We'll go have it one more time. I'll carry over House Bill 3379 and 3416. And is there anything else? That was another one I had question marks on. I think we've carried over everything else. Except for this one. Yeah, I'm still at that now. And okay, sorry. Let me reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2508. And please continue.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Rice, what was your first name again?
Don Rice.
Don Rice, okay.
Great, thank you. So just picking up what we're here today is looking for support for a process to protect the agricultural area when the siting of transmission lines. And so just as a quick example of our concern, the Boardman-Hemingway project, its proposed transmission line, the minimum easement they're looking for is a 250-foot wide easement. And so for us, we have 2 miles of the current proposed route. And so at 30 acres per mile on the minimum easement, and that may expand depending on how close they decide they can put transmission lines together, but a minimum of 30 acres per mile. We've been going to meetings for years with Idaho Power, with both in private and public, with Bonneville Power Administration, with the Pacific Northwest infrastructure team, and BLM, others, with little recognition for our input. And it's been a wonderful process. We've got to meet a lot of great people from Idaho and other places, but there's been little reception of our input. And so we're looking for some help in the process. In the current draft environmental impact statement for the Boardman-Hemingway line, the comment out of there is that the impact to agriculture would be minimal for 1 to 3 years, and that's kind of the approach we get, that it's inconsequential, but in reality it's in perpetuity taking our land out of production. And so we need some greater thought given to protection of agricultural land. And I just use Boardman-Hemingway as an example. There's currently 3 lines proposed to go through our area, Boardman-Hemingway, and 2 wind projects. And so it just multiplies the problem. So once again, I just ask your support for the protection of agriculture, and I'd like to extend a thank you to Farm Bureau for their leadership on this issue.
So
Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing us to come before you today. I have to admit, when I didn't realize today was OSU Day when I wore my WSU coat into the room, so I apologize for that. My name is Tim Tippett. I represent the interest of processors and farmers in the Umatilla and Morrow County area, namely Pasco Farming, which is a farming operation in the Morrow County area, as well as Oregon Potato Company and other affiliates, which are owned by Frank Teagues. We're not just farmers. We also are we're highly diversified, and if Mr. Teagues could be here today, he would say to you that his motto is from the seed to the fork. We don't just grow these products to sell. We process them as well. And it's very important. You heard the word used earlier, sustainability. That is an absolute important word to us. We sell to many of the major companies throughout the world, whether it be Frito-Lay, Kellogg's, which now owns the Pringles brand, General Mills, Unilever, Kraft, Heinz. Sustainability implies to them that we have either control or own the land base upon which we grow these crops. They don't want to be coming in and doing business with some weak outfit that doesn't have control of their land in the event that there are alternatives for people to grow crops upon, and therefore they're unable to then provide the products to feed these plants. Our particular plant there in Boardman grinds about 1,000 tons of potatoes a day. It's important that we have the raw to feed these plants. Also, looking down the road in the future, you have the diversification here, right here in your own valley, for crops such as sweet corn, peas, beans, and whatnot. As those alternatives become less and less viable, we may have to look at the north central Oregon region to supply some of those crops to these plants here, such as National Frozen Foods right here in Albany. We acquired Oregon Potato in 2001, and it together with our farming operation right there in Morrow County employs approximately 200 people. And as I don't know if it was mentioned, but they're not making any more of this land today. It's important that we maintain this land base upon which to grow these crops. If we lose this, and particularly in potatoes, if you lose 1 acre, it takes 4 acres to go out and replace it, simply because of the required rotation to grow potatoes. The added cost to bring potatoes into the region is goes right to the bottom line, so that becomes expensive as well. We understand the need for power. I think that's a given. We currently farm in Idaho as well, about 60,000 acres. So we're a large customer of Idaho Power. So we understand the need for that. So we're not trying to say that we don't want this line. We just need the tools by which to have this line placed elsewhere. There are more reasonable and practical locations for that particular location. Potatoes is not only the thing that we grow. We also grow blueberries and grapes, which again are high value crops. Now I realize you're talking about high value in land, but high value crops as well. So we have spent a lot of money ourselves defending this, and we feel that there are probably more common sense and reasonable locations to place this line, and we request that you consider the legislations by which to allow us to defend our rights. Thank you very much.
Any questions for these gentlemen? Quick, Representative Gillian.
This is a good gut and stuff. Often we don't care for gut and stuff, particularly if it's your own bill. And I appreciate your work on this. I can't think of anything more important to my region than agriculture, or to the Northwest region than our power. That I think somebody said, maybe it was just before you, there happened to be a few dams on that river. Maybe you said that. And the advantage that hydroelectricity obviously means to the Northwest. This kind of working out a solution and making sure we protect ag and not get too excited about power lines is very attractive to me. Do we have, I appreciate the input from the, excuse me, Farm Bureau, but You mentioned Idaho Power. How are the discussions with Power folks and with the BPA, for instance? Can you clue us in on that? And if I missed that at some point, I was out of the room, I'm sorry.
Well, we've had, this is Don Rice for the record, Chairman Clem, Representative Gillum. We've had many meetings with them. There's been lots of turnover in staff at Idaho Power, and seems like every couple of meetings we have to kind of go back to ground one and so forth. Our spirit through the whole thing has been to try to find a way that works and minimizes the impacts to accommodate both, because we need power as well as the land. It's been difficult getting them to look at other options, hence we're here asking for some support.
Chair Clem, if I may follow up one quick on that. Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, the other thing that, and I will say, and I, Margie Hoff is not here today, but we've been working pretty closely with the energy advisor for the governor, because this isn't a new issue, but the region has developed, we believe, two corridors that we think are worthwhile for consideration. Unfortunately, both corridors are not on the current permit process, with both the federal process through NEPA, which we consider a southerly route, and also a route that requires a northerly route with an easement from the bombing range from the Navy. In our packet that we provided to you from NAWA today, you'll see that the Navy has a very strict policy directorate that should other alternatives that be deemed viable, they more or less do not have to grant an easement across their property. So unfortunately, with the routes that are currently under the BLM consideration, that negates the ability for the Navy to be able to say that those routes aren't viable. Likewise, with the southerly route, the concern there is that that is not on the current draft environmental impact statement. Nor do we understand that there's intention to include that on the amendment to the Energy Facility Siting Council amendment to the state, which is very concerning to us, because that amendment sets the goalpost that prevents us from implementing this type of a fix, hopefully, with some legal sideboards to maybe force that analyzation. Both of those routes, just so everyone's aware, actually doesn't just fix the Idaho Power issue, but it provides a corridor that also helps the wind industry get to the grid. We don't want to just fix one problem to jump right into another, and that's one of the reasons why we thought it might be better to look at with the Farm Bureau. Is there a way that we can facilitate or incentivize corridor planning by putting some sideboards on protecting the land until such types of plans are completed? So that's the intent. And again, the other clarification is that this is only for overhead transmission lines. Our region works very well with undergrounds. They do impact at times and need easements, but for the most part, you can farm over the top of them. And when you're doing early application of spray and seed, which you'll hear from the dairy folks, they don't seem to run into those things. So that being said, we've taken a careful approach to try to tighten this up to fix a specific issue. But that being said, given the quick turnaround in the gut and stuff, we recognize there might be some issues that come up that we need to address. So I'll be quiet, because you know me, Representative Clem, I could talk a lot. So,
further questions, members of the committee?
Well, now that I have the floor.
You're about to get the gavel, too, in a second, because I've got to go testify on something.
Representative, we should keep talking about this and whatever we can do to help.
We have like 12 more witnesses.
Do we?
Yeah.
I'm going to be quiet now.
Yeah. So, thank you for now. And I've got, normally I try and go pro-con, but I also have 200 milers here. So I'm going to do Jeff Bosma and Irene Gilbert really quickly, because you came a long ways and I want to make sure I get you in. And then I'll go and let some people who aren't so crazy about this talk. So please.
First.
I'll go first. I came with them, so all we have to hear. Chairman Clem, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for hearing this important bill. My name is Jeff Bosma. I operate Sage Hollow Dairy. We purchased the farm in 2006 and have invested approximately $40 million in a 3,000 cow dairy and a young stock feeding facility. Farm supports my family and 45 employees. The proposed B2H Longhorn route goes directly over top of our dairy.
this is not a compatible use.
This is not a scary thing. He hasn't ever chaired this before, but I have to go testify next door. So we're going to see what happens.
Please continue.
Continue. Okay. We have two substantial concerns with this. First, high voltage overhead power lines interfere with our ability to meet the requirements of our CAFO and NPDES permits through the loss of available farmland and common farming practices. And second, high voltage overhead transmission lines create stray voltage through induction, which is harmful to cow health and has a negative impact on animal welfare. I believe this bill is good for Oregon agriculture, the environment, and animal welfare. I want to thank you for listening and also Farm Bureau for supporting us.
Thank you. Please go right ahead.
My name's Irene Gilbert. I'm from La Grande, Oregon. I do have some tree farm land in Linn County, as well as some pasture land. And in a prior life, my ex-husband and I were part of a fairly large cattle and timber operation in Linn County. So we sold about 200 head of feeder calves every fall. And about twice a year, we would sit down as a family unit and try to figure out how many more head than 200 we would need to sell in order to make a profit. And we owned all the land. So at any rate, there are many bills that are currently going through the legislature that are putting an inordinate impact on family farms. And I am here in support of Senate Bill 2508, because this would require that at least when they're citing things like Boardman to Hemingway, that they look at the impacts on high-value farmland. And I'll give you an example of the kinds of impacts that I'm concerned with. While we did not use pivotal irrigation systems here in the valley, in eastern Oregon, it's a very common practice for irrigation. Those pivotal irrigation systems are very expensive. They can be $80,000, $100,000 to put in and often cover an area of up to 500 acres. Now, when you put a transmission line through an area that's being irrigated by one of those systems, you're not talking about 30 acres per mile. You're talking about someone having to tear out a very expensive system and re-engineer the entire thing. So this goes way beyond just the right-of-way area. The other concern that I have is we have a rancher outside of La Grande where the current Boardman to Hemingway project is going to go right through an area that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has said is probably the most important elk habitat for reproduction, bar any in the United States other than Jackson Hole. So my impression is that the Boardman to Hemingway project, they kind of have an idea of what they want to do. They are not listening to the people in terms of looking at other alternatives. I know the rancher that has this area with the elk calving has said that he really is willing to work with them about another alternative. He's not getting a positive response up to this point. So that's really my comment. I really appreciate having this bill heard. I hope that it's possible for me to turn in a written response. I did not provide a written response, but I didn't realize that I was going to be talking to not very many people. So I hope that's okay.
It's okay. I didn't realize I was going to be chairing this.
Okay. I do very much appreciate having this heard. I really wish I knew where Representative Clem was doing his shopping, because I'd probably avoid it.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. There were some other orange pants here.
That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much for your testimony and for taking the time to come. I'm going to ask former Senator and former State Representative Roger Beyer to come forward now. He used to represent such a distinguished area of our state that I thought I'd have him come up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. You just heard from one of our members on this bill. I think we're speaking to a -1 amendment, I believe. Is that correct? So I don't think I have much to add that he didn't already add. Dairy farmers can't really function with high transmission wires going right off the top of their farms, and we think there's better ways to site these. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any stimulating questions you might have for me.
Thank you, Roger, for being here. And we miss you, because so few of my colleagues are as brief as you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How about Diane, is it Diana Gardner, and Marianne Nash from Oregon Farm Bureau next?
I anticipated this problem.
And Diana, go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Representative Gilliam. I'm a Marion County farmer in your district. I have hazelnuts, seed crops, and grains. My farm is traversed at present by a BPA high-tension line, overhead power line.
Tell me again where are you?
A little east of Howell Prairie Road.
Oh, sure.
South of Silverton and north of Sublimity.
Yeah.
Good. West of Cascade Highway.
If I'd known you were going to be here, I'd have had you up before Roger, but go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's west of Cascade Highway,
yeah.
East of Howell Prairie Road. I support the bill as it is written. Since the 1980s, I have been involved in four protracted land use issues, a road through our orchard, a subdivision on high-value farmland, and transmission line site proposals by PGE and by BPA on our property. In each of these cases, local government and public agencies either did nothing to help the farmer beyond the minimum of holding public hearings or actively supported the conflicting projects. The point I want to emphasize for the committee is that in the cases of the road through the 250-acre orchard and 30 houses on 30 acres of land very remote from any urban boundary, I was able to use existing land use law to prevail against these proposals. However, in the face of the transmission line projects, we farmers are practically helpless. Had the PGA and BPA proposals been financially feasible, and they were not, and that's why they were either altered to be almost harmless in the case of the BPA, or discarded completely, the Cascade Crossing, I'm sure you've heard much about it.
Yeah.
Owners of many thousands of highly productive farmland would have been financially damaged in the long term, in perpetuity. And we would not be able to modify or stop these projects under existing conditions. So the regulations for protecting farmers from these transmission projects overwhelmingly fails utilities, even when alternative routes through less critical resource land are available. In fact, we have found with our experience with the Cascade Crossings, that highly productive farmland is actually favored by utilities because it's generally level and it's clear. And there are very few people living on it to get in the way.
It's an unfortunate confluence, isn't it?
It's easy. It's the easiest thing to do. Mm-hmm. So Boardman to Salem, which would have served Portland, the Cascade Crossings, would have come all the way down through eastern Oregon to the Santiam Canyon, swung around through Salem over my land, and gone back up to Oregon City because that was seen to be the easier than going through Clackamas County, which is heavily settled. So the compensations for these encumbrances is quite pathetic. There's a payment for the one-time value of the raw land, and there's no compensation at all for ongoing expenses and encumbrances for the loss of productive potential through time and for the limited crop and management choices that we're left with. On my property, I have two enormous sags in the BPA line. I have three towers involved with sags between them. And because of the topography, almost nothing can be grown under those power lines. Seed crops. We can't put hazelnuts in, which is what we would prefer. Even vineyards would probably be denied. Welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Shall I continue?
Please.
Thank you. If there were clarity of responsibility requiring local government and public agencies to participate actively in protecting highly productive farmland, these issues could be settled fairly in ways that accomplish both energy delivery and land preservation. So I believe that HB 2508 accomplishes this, and I hope that the committee can support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, that was good testimony. I'm sorry you missed it, but she has written testimony for us as well.
Excellent.
So it's Mary Ann. Right?
Yeah, she has not gone.
So Mary Ann, can I ask you just to, so I need to get some people opposed to this up.
Absolutely.
Here, and I forgot to leave that message before I left the room. So
thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Could I have Evan and Varner and Annette Price? Sorry about that. I forgot to leave any instructions when I left about that topic, and I think we were just going right down the list.
Sure. Chair Klim, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. Portland General Electric is opposed to HB 2508-1, and the basic concern that we have is that as we step back a little bit and reflect on the issues that we're looking at here today, electricity is increasingly an integral part of what our economy uses to function today. Powers our computers, powers the high-tech economy that we have, powers the lights, you know, for this hearing room and this microphone. We are, as we go forward, we're going to continue to develop new generation. I think that there are multiple proposals in front of this body, including the hearing room next door, where we're talking about decarbonizing what our electrical generation mix is for the state. And the truth is we're going to need to develop new transmission lines as we go forward, as we shift from higher carbon intensity resources to less carbon intensive resources over time. That's going to require some new build of transmission. I'm absolutely sympathetic to, and I understand the concerns that folks have raised in terms of the siting of transmission lines. And I think that good process to figure out what the proper routing is and figuring out how you avoid conflicts to the extent possible is extremely important. With that said, with HB 2508 and the -1 amendments, I think that there are some significant questions that need to be worked through. We're looking at changes to Oregon's land use planning. We're looking at changes to the FSEC siting process. And that could potentially have implications as we go forward for not just the Boardman-Hemingway line that folks are talking about right now, but it could impact what work we need to do to site new transmission facilities, new generation tie lines from developed solar projects and wind projects, which this legislature is appearing to be pretty strongly in support of. And I think that the question we need to ask ourselves is, what would be the implications for the permitting and the siting of future projects, and how do we make sure that what we have in terms of transmission line siting matches up with the other public policy objectives that this body is considering? You know, as Chair Klim, as you're fully aware, I mean, land use planning can get to be pretty complicated. It has some intricacies associated with it. So I believe. It's not my area of expertise. The FSEC siting process also carries with it that degree of complexity and intricacy. The way that in sort of a brief looking, just as we're preparing testimony today and looking at this bill, we don't know how this would necessarily impact our ability to build that next round of generation that we need to for the state. Not to say that we're callous to the concerns that people have raised here. We absolutely understand them. Siting of transmission lines is very difficult, especially as state population grows, and especially as the prosperity of some of our ag endeavors are growing, which is a great thing. But we want to make sure that we're being thoughtful and that we're following a pretty good process. And we think that this bill is simply not ready to pass at this point in the session. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, for the record, Ebony Andrews, representing Idaho Power. Idaho Power does not support legislation that makes it more difficult to site transmission lines in Oregon. We feel that existing Oregon law strikes the proper balance in allowing a utility to site a transmission project in an EFU zone by requiring the utility to make a significant showing regarding the impacts to EFU lands and to minimize and mitigate those impacts. The Dash 1 Amendment would set a new and higher standard for transmission line projects in EFU areas, potentially resulting in a policy that would impede the development of much-needed critical transmission infrastructure. Further, by requiring transmission lines to be sited to the least or to the maximum extent possible on the least productive farmland versus highly productive farmland, the amendment would seemingly create a new hierarchy among EFU lands and would discriminate against the least productive farmland businesses. To the extent that the amendment provisions would apply to applications currently pending before FSEC, those applications would be impacted particularly hard as the applicant would need to revise the applications to address the new standard, which could impact the routes pending before FSEC and federal entities and possibly cause further delays. For these reasons, Idaho Power does not support the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, my name is Annette Price. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Pacific Power. And in the interest of time, Pacific Power does not support the Dash 1 amendments. And I'd like to echo and add an exclamation point to the remarks that my colleagues have just made, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions for these three?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one.
Representative Gilliam.
Can you... any of you specifically address very low compensation as one issue and how you interpret both the Dash 1s in this regard and also the position of the companies that you represent? And before you comment on that, I want to be sure that I put on the record that I understand the pressure that this particular legislature is putting on you all, and I don't agree with much of that legislation, and I don't have solutions other than my no vote. And as you know, I am critical to every vote that's taken in this session. Anyway, if you had a comment on the low compensation, I'd be grateful.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, I'll be honest, I'm not 100% versed in terms of what the methodology is for determining compensation. We'd be happy to look into that and walk through with you later time exactly how that's structured. More broadly speaking, I think one of the things that when we talk about energy issues and I think almost every committee where we've testified on energy issues this session, one of the things we've had to talk about is that when there are costs put on to the electrical system, those are paid for by Oregonians. That it effectively, if you raise the cost of permitting and compensating landowners for a transmission line and for the disturbances associated with that, that's money that ultimately comes out of the pockets of ratepayers. One of the things that the state has is a statutory objective for investor-owned utilities, regulated utilities in the state of Oregon, is that we're to conduct our activities in a way which is the least risk and the least cost for the ratepayers of the state of Oregon. So we do have, as a state, on the books, a policy objective to keep the costs of electrical generation very low. And so all of the components that go into that, the salaries that we pay for folks, what we pay for power, how we do our long-term planning for what resources we bring on, all of those are tied back to that least cost, least risk methodology. In terms of the exact methodology for determining the compensation landowners, I'll have to get back to you on the answer to that question.
Further questions?
No, but I would add, how many more have we got? I know you don't want
basically
to.
Basically three. Two in favor, one
particularly
of
because you're up here. Yeah. This is a little bit off the subject, but this bill, to me, screams for hydrogen development and hydrogen hubs. And there's an individual in your company whose uncle is the guru of this. And I don't know if you had a chance to meet Jack, but hydrogen hubs would mean everything to this issue and to all of our energy issues. and it's not something to discuss today.
Oh, no, the bill relates to the use of land.
Good point. But I don't want to hold up any more testifiers. But we've got to find some solutions other than just tightening the penalties for carbon use and mitigating between food that we need and power that we need. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Klim, Representative Gilliam, perhaps after this hearing you should walk next door.
What's next door?
House Energy Environment is considering carbon pricing, so your testimony would be welcome. Thank you, sir.
They kicked me off that committee, but maybe I can sneak in the back.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I've got this right. I've got three left. Mary Ann, back up. Steve McCoy. And then we can all be nice. So, Gary, do you want to testify? Pretty much what they just said. Okay. But you can back clean up after these two if you still want to. You can see how much damage they do and then reserve your right.
Yeah, we've got to hear from Mr. Northwest Natural.
Yeah, well, yeah. Okay, please. Sorry to kick you out earlier.
Chair Klim, remaining member of the committee. My name is Mary Ann Nash, Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau, here to testify in support of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2508. We view House Bill 2508 as a really positive step in terms of getting utility companies to more effectively engage with farmers and to really analyze the impacts that these transmission facilities have on agricultural land. There's currently not a strong mechanism for impacted farmers to engage with the utility companies and no requirement of an alternatives analysis regardless of the impacts to farmland. Oregon Farm Bureau would like to see farmers be able to engage in these discussions throughout farm zone land, but we view this bill as an important step toward ensuring that our most productive lands are protected during the development process. To be clear, Oregon Farm Bureau supports energy development, but emphasizes that planning for development and transmission facilities must be undertaken in a thoughtful manner and designed to minimize impact on other uses. This is particularly important with transmission lines and other infrastructure because of the likelihood of future expansion along the right-of-ways created by these transmission facilities. I do want to emphasize we've heard a lot about the Boardman to Hemingway project, but this is not just an issue in northeastern Oregon. We're seeing transmission facility projects pop up around the state, and I know you all are aware of several counties that have had previous experiences, including Marion, Malheur, Baker, and Washington County. And so we would like to see, again, broader protection for all agricultural lands in the process, but this is a really good start toward making sure that on our most productive lands, existing uses are protected and that, if there is a feasible alternative, that it's really examined and there's an actual meaningful way for the farmers to participate in the process. In response to a couple of the comments that I heard earlier, I think the increase in the number of these projects is precisely the need for a more effective process and a process that enables farmers to engage more directly. We don't think this will halt or interfere with the ability to construct transmission facilities, but would instead actually create a process which, when under the threat of condemnation, there's just no real incentive for it to exist. And we've seen this play out in several instances where an entity has condemnation power. There's just not a great incentive for them to look at minimizing impacts to agricultural lands, particularly when, as we said, a lot of times the value calculation isn't in tune with the actual value of the land, the value of the inputs and the production value, and the associated economic value to the community. We've talked a lot in this committee about rural communities and issues facing rural communities, and the agricultural inputs that come from the land have a huge impact on the community's the economic viability of communities. And so when we lose this productive land, it has a tenfold increase in terms of impacts that resonate out into the community. So we think this is a really important process and would really urge the committee to support this bill.
Great. Steve?
Chair Klim, Representative Gilliam, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important issue this afternoon. I'll be brief. You've already heard me talk about the importance of Oregon's agricultural industry to the state. number two industry, 1 in 8 jobs, 15% of the state product, $22 billion industry. It's really important. And the intent of this bill is to ensure that the most important farmlands in the state are protected from being unnecessarily consumed by this particular non-farm use. There have been several high-profile instances, which we've heard about. We've heard about Boardman to Hemingway, as well as the Cascade Crossing today. They've been cited without recognizing the impact that they would have on agricultural businesses that are in their path. The Dash Ones require an analysis of these conflicts. The bill would protect farmlands from being unnecessarily consumed for non-farm uses. Therefore, we fully support the intent of the Dash Ones. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Gary. All right. Last word. Did I miss anybody? I had Stephen Cafori, but I don't see him here.
I think he said he submitted written.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, please.
Thank you, Chair Clem and former acting Chair Gilliam. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I'll be very brief. Actually, the Dash One amendments are written to not include natural gas, but we're trying to kind of ascertain through our legal counsel is whether or not that changes the process that we have used in the past by changing the definitions. So we're still taking a look at that. We use outside legal counsel when it comes to citing issues, and that individual is not available today. I might just make just one other quick comment that our last major line that we did through a siting process was through the Energy Facility Siting Council. We actually altered that route, added 10 miles to it to accommodate both land use and environmental issues. So, and in that process, we do an analysis of multiple routes in order to kind of determine the one that has the least amount of impact. Any major linear project will have some impacts. And unfortunately, that's just the nature of any kind of linear project, whether it's a pipeline, electric transmission line, sewer line, water line, we all will have some kind of an impact. Thank you.
Okay, with that and seeing no any questions for...
I have a question for him.
Yeah.
Thank you for pointing out how tough linear projects are. I've just never run into that since I've been state representative. And thank you for your willingness to try to mitigate some of those. But I want to understand that a major utility using outside legal counsel at who knows what rate can't get the person today, so we have answers up here?
Chair Clem, formerly acting Chair Gilliam, correct. Thank you.
I'm done.
Okay. And okay. Seeing that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3520. I need to carry over House Bill 25, the possible work session on House Bill. No, I just closed the public hearing on the wrong one.
2508.
I closed the public hearing on House Bill 2508, carry over the possible work session on House Bill 2508, carry over the work session on House Bill 2463, and the only one I need to decide on is...
We can recess and review.
Yeah, we're standing recess for just a second. Okay, and I'm going to carry over the... did I have a possible work session scheduled? Yeah, possible work session on House Bill 3520. And I think that is everything. Not, we still have the use of land. With that, we'll adjourn the committee. Thanks.